I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With a new episode every Macabre Monday, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers. We are back this week for part two of our J-horror.
Yeah.
And this week, I liked a little bit more, I'm not going to lie.
A little bit? Get out of here.
You liked a lot more. A lot more. You know what, though?
So did I.
I found, you know, so much to like about the Tetsuo in the research part of it.
Baffling me.
Right. And so, like, this week, I even found more to like. But talking about two really great films this week.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think it's going to be a lot easier on us.
Yay!
So, last week, in detailing Japan's history and sort of spiritual and cultural history, you talked about how the combination of Buddhism and Shintoism led to, like, sort of intermingling philosophies, and right. It dictates the subtext of a lot of, like, you know, what they find spooky, their relationship with the dead, ghosts,
right.
etc. So, I found a really good article on horror.com. Dream Dawn, where the title is Chris's Guide to Understanding Japanese Horror.
That's nice.
And it was very convenient and very well written. So a lot of what I'm about to deliver is coming from that article. So as I mentioned, the two main religions of Japan are Buddhism and Shinto. Buddhism was brought by Korean scholars to Japan from China around 500 AD, but Shinto is indigenous to the country. Interestingly, most Japanese people today practice both Shinto and Buddhism depending on the circumstances. For example, weddings are often Shinto, while funerals are typically Buddhist. For most people, religious rituals are performed because they're traditional, not because they imply some strong religious alignment. Thanks to this religious flexibility, Japanese culture has a wealth of legends and beliefs to draw upon from two different religions. Buddhism teaches that life is a facade, and the never-ending cycle of death and rebirth can only be avoided by convincing oneself of this deception. That's
it's really dramatic.
That's complicated, yeah.
It's very dramatic.
Many Buddhist ghost stories are designed to reinforce that idea. For example, Lafcadio O'Hearn's translation of Fragment, in which a Buddhist monk climbs a mountain only to find that it is comprised entirely of the bones of his former lives.
So existential.
That is so fucking
right?
Dark. Wow. Yeah, no, I mean, that's like the next level from Sisyphus. That is really...
It's extra.
Yeah. Shinto, on the other hand, teaches that any dead person can be prayed to or otherwise has very little to say about life after death. Now on to the fun stuff, the apparitions and monsters.
Yeah.
Otherworldly Japanese creatures can be broken down into two categories: yukai and yurei. Yukai are weird beings that are often as bizarre as they are scary, typically physical as opposed to the more ethereal yurei. Yukai are similar to Western monsters. They are animal-like and often dim-witted.
Good.
And
I like to think that I could, like, get one up on, like, the catfish monster.
Yeah, I think these are, like, the mini-bosses, and, like,
right.
They cater particularly to, like, animation.
Good.
Though they may be malicious, they seldom maintain any long-term goals or plan. Again, dim-witted.
Yeah, fine.
Short attention span. This class of monsters includes goblins and ogres and the like, as well as neutral or benevolent creatures such as the tanuki, a shape-shifting prankster that looks like a large raccoon.
Yes, Tanuki Mario, we know.
Oh, you already knew this one. Okay, so Mario's raccoon suit is based on one of the yokai.
Yeah, and then he becomes a statue.
Oh, you're ahead of me.
Yeah. Oh, I know about Mario. That's some stuff I know about.
So yurei, on the other hand, are the heart of Japanese horror. Yurei are ghosts or spirits that have been stranded on this world because they have some unfinished business or because they died while in the throes of intense emotion. Unlike yokai, yurei have a singular purpose or mission, and they are often malicious. A person who becomes a ghost is said to forget everything else from their life and focus only on that which prevents them from resting. There are scores of stories, like the story of Okiku, that depict ghosts who have come back to haunt their murderers or to express the anguish that led to their suicide or to reward those who fulfill their dying wish. because this sounded like such a familiar idea, I immediately thought of the idea that I thought was a Western one, just as far as like a, say like a murder or some tragic event is so bad that it's sort of sinks into the atmosphere of a place.
Yeah.
Like, you know, your haunted house, your graveyards, that kind of thing.
Everyone has this.
Sure. And I always kind of, you know, you hear, I mean, it's a standard ghost story.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got nothing to do with any Western, you know, minded Judeo-Christian or even Muslim belief that I'm familiar with. So it's a weird little bit of Buddhism that sort of got grabbed onto and used in Western culture. But it's got no place in our actual foundations, not my personal foundations, but, you know, Puritanical America. The underlying concept behind Japanese yurei is onin, the idea that some emotions are so strong that their power can extend from beyond the grave. Almost all classic and contemporary ghost stories from Japan operate on onin, in addition to the obvious case of Okiku, witness Sadako's character in The Ring, an antagonist in Ju-on, or even the explanations given for Hanako's origin in Hanako in the Toilet Story. Have you come across any of that one?
No, but okay, you know I'm like scared also of toilets because of ghoulies.
It's toilet in the European sense. It's just bathroom.
Oh. Because ghoulies like fucked up my life.
Oh, me. Yeah. The basic cable as a young kid. Like I was always checking the toilet hopping on.
And garbage pail kids, that happened too.
The Japanese often portray yurei as people dressed in white funeral garb with long, dark hair. Should sound familiar. Originally, yurei were portrayed in art and theater as indistinguishable from regular people, but it was in the 18th century that style changed. Since then, the legs of the ghosts seem to fade into thin air. They are often shown to have arms outstretched and hands limp. For some reason, yurei seem to very frequently be female. That's big surprise there. We sort of tiptoed around the idea that like a lot of this traditional culture is pretty misogynistic.
Yeah,
it's the farthest thing from feminist work.
One of my big notes here on this other text that we'll talk about when it comes time is just it's like patriarchy. It's like really big.
Yeah, and any opportunity to sort of call out, like, oh, you women and your scorn.
Yes, the most vengeful ghosts in Japanese literature or plays like kabuki are going to be ladies. Woo,
yeah.
Watch out.
Therein is another sort of another place where Western culture and Eastern culture, it's like, hey, they've got that in common. It's like, women be tripping.
Ladies are crazy.
Japanese yurei tend to haunt a specific person or place. Since yurei have an explicit reason for sticking around in the mortal plane, they do not often waste their time attacking people who have no relationship to them. But what fun is that in a ghost story?
Yeah.
You want to expand
also,
that.
Also, like, what else are they doing?
Yeah.
Anyone who wanders in, I'm going to mess with if I'm a ghost.
I got time. I got nothing but time in this afterworld. Okay, so a lot of the stuff we talked about should sound very familiar for those familiar with The Ring and The Grudge. Now, personally, I kind of spoiled these movies for myself having seen the American versions first.
The American Ring first, but not Grudge. I did Grudge the right way around.
Okay.
But The Ring, I saw, I think, the American version first.
Yeah, the Gore Verbinski version, I mean, both The Grudge and The Ring, the American versions, are solid flicks.
Yeah.
I really dig those. Individual from these original Japanese movies we're going to talk about. But that said, the original Japanese movies have like a very natural sensibility to them. When things start going weird, it's that much more fanciful because we haven't changed the aesthetic from the reality that we're used
right.
to. The Verbinski one is far more stylized, and I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. But why don't we jump in with 1998's The Ring. And how I saw it described is even the trailer made for American audiences refers to it as Ringu, but the ooh is very soft.
Okay.
So it's like Ringu, I guess.
Oh,
I
like
know.
A schwa. Ring it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. All right. Fair enough.
Directed by Hideo Nakata, he also made the original Dark Water,
mm-hmm.
also based on Koji Suzuki's novel. And he also made Ringu 2 and the American version of The Ring 2, we're going to find that between these two filmmakers, they retread their steps quite a bit.
Yes. Well, when something's working and you can get a lot of money, just keep doing it.
Oh, yeah. This was, like, these were considerably low-budget movies. The Grudge has a fascinating history, but The Ring was only made for, like, $1.2 million. Mm-hmm. And I think it still stands as Japan's highest-grossing horror film, at least. I don't know if it's film overall, but definitely horror movie. Screenplay by Hiroshi Takashi, based on the 1991 novel by Koji Suzuki. We talked a little bit about Japan's slow transition to equality of the sexes, but to Hiroshi's credit, he gender swapped a number of the characters, so we now have a woman protagonist protecting her son,
right,
and her ex-husband is sort of the helper of the story. I guess we have to give a synopsis for anyone unfamiliar. Right?
I'm trying to think of what the synopsis might be. Like, if I had to give a synopsis, what would I say?
This is a sparse one. A reporter and her ex-husband investigate a cursed videotape that is rumored to kill the viewer 7 days after watching it. Essentially, a death curse by way of a chain letter.
Yeah, but what's great about this one is, yes, it's horror, clearly, through and through horror, but it's a detective story.
Yeah.
It is a detective story.
It reminds me of, like, pandemic stories when they're sort of trying to track down patient zero, the mm-hmm. origin point of this outbreak. In this case, like, people are dying, so same.
It's great. It's really, really nice in that way. It's not a particularly violent film on screen. And what you have to think about in 1998 is we're still watching slasher at this point in time, and that's what's really, especially in American horror film at this time, we're still on the idea of slasher. Blair Witch is very new, and not everyone loved that kind of idea.
Sure, yeah, a lot of people got sick.
And it's kind of like something like this comes along where it's a real slow burn. It's truly a detective story. We're not seeing the gore on screen, and it changed really the way horror movies were being made at that time.
Yeah, it introduced an entirely new aesthetic.
Because you talk about the early
2000s. New to American audiences.
Yeah. Early 2000s American horror is so influenced by The Ring, by The Grudge. I mean, beyond just the remakes, any of those I Know What You Did Last Summer sequels become more like this from the first one.
I thought it was a funny reaction I had, that this is one level removed from what I'm used to as far as, you know, American audiences speaking English. And so early on in the story, when Nanako is talking about urban myths, and, you know, it's in the context of, like, a newsroom, so she's not, you know, she's not treating it like a kid and sort of these stories. She's talking about specific locations and accounts mm-hmm. the way a reporter would. And because there's that one level removed, and it's so naturalistic. That conversation is not sensationalist. She's not talking about these things like they should be dreaded. It's just kind of matter of fact. It's like mm-hmm. every neighborhood has their own ghost story kind of background. And there was a moment where I was like, maybe there are ghosts in Japan. Like, maybe every neighborhood has, like, a ghost mascot. And, yeah, then it just kind of sunk in. It's like, no, I still don't believe in ghosts. But but there was that one level I was suspending disbelief.
You're like, maybe so. When you think of The Ring, you think of, well, the American version, you think of Samara. In this one, Sadako. Mm-hmm. And you think of that image. You see the hair over the face. You see one eye. Funeral garb, like we were just talking about, white. This is what you think of, and it's such an iconic image of this film. What's really cool to think is that image comes from a kabuki play in the 1800s.
Okay.
And it's a story. This is a combination of Okiku, which we were speaking about earlier, and Oiwa. Oiwa was poisoned by her husband, and the poison turns her into this hairless, one-eyed monster. That's what this image of Sadako comes from, putting the hair so that only one eye shows. It's directly from this 1800s play, which I'm thinking to myself, like, kabuki must have been awesome and scary as shit, right?
In the days where that was the entertainment standard. Yeah.
Yeah, so it comes from, in case anyone wants to kind of seek it out, it comes from the play The Ghost Story of Yatsuya, and that's where that image directly comes from, and I think that's so creepy. So scary. The other story that this shares is the idea of this well, which is Akiku. And the Akiku story is where she was a servant and there were 10 plates, but she breaks one and it's different kind of in every story that you hear it in. One of the plates goes missing, essentially, and she gets killed for it. And they throw her in the well. And that's where the well comes from. And then she's like crying in the well. What's kind of cool about Akiku is that she's always looking for that 10th plate. So she'll kill people like 9 of them and she's looking for 10. And the way they beat her in one of the plays that takes place in that was written in the 1800s, late 1800s, they beat her by like the detective says 10 because she's counting. And that's how he beats her. You know, it's like she just couldn't make it to 10. And what's great about these stories, so this is where it ties in with this, like, patriarchy kind of idea. It's that vengeful ghost, right? That's the idea. That's what these stories are really, really based on. If you want to be a badass, you're going to be a lady ghost. There's no other way around it.
I hope this is true. It's presumed that Shizuko Yamamura is based on a real person, Chizuku Mifune, who was born in 1886 in Kumamoto Prefecture and was rumored to have a gift of foresight. After a demonstration in 1910, she was proclaimed a charlatan and committed suicide a year later by ingesting poison. So I do kind of love that, like, every little bit and piece of this story has a history to it. Like, right. there is no, like, piece untouched that's just kind of like, well, we invented some shit.
Hey, that Edo period and closing off everything, they were coming up with some great shit. So the listener knows we do sometimes a lot of research and we go to the library, which is always very exciting. And I found this awesome article, everyone needs to look it up, by Eric KWU. It's called A Traditional Vengeful Ghost or The Machine in a Ghost, Narrative Dynamics, Horror Effects, and Post-Human in Ringu. Oh. It's, yeah, very... It took me a few times to literally read this article. And it's a short article, but it's really, really in-depth. And it talks about this idea of post-humanism.
Okay.
Okay. And where I started to really find this Ringu Tetsuo kind of connection is in this post-humanism ideal where it plays with technology and regular ghosts and putting these two together, these two ideas together. This article plays on the idea that Sadako is a ghost in a machine ideal. Instead of just being a ghost, we have the video and it needs the video to continue going forward.
Yeah, I think there's a component of Shinto where objects can sort of inherit a spirit.
Right.
And an inanimate object all of a sudden becomes like a horcrux.
Exactly. And in this, though, that machine can copy and multiply. And let me just read this and blow your mind for a second. In a sequel to the original novel, we do see the stunning picture of many copies of Sadako spreading all over places, but not having any interactions with each other at all. Traditional ghosts, in comparison, are always imagined as more or less unified beings. When Sadako's copies are everywhere, we can hardly tell which one is the original. Furthermore, when Sadako no longer cares about who maltreated her and seeks them out for revenge, when she does not even want social acceptance as represented by a proper burial in her homeland, it were as though the details of her previous traumatic personal life and even her social identity had become meaningless. As if oblivious of her past history, none of the Sadakos, we might surmise, enjoy some sort of authentic selfhood. This is not to deny that at the diegetic level, the murder did not happen, but that at the end of the story, whatever happened then no longer matters now, that the aura or eventness of the original event has already waned.
Wow, it's talking about this haunting like it's a computer program.
Exactly.
Like each tape is this isolated program that just runs its course, individual of the other tapes, and essentially the spirit itself.
Right, so she starts as a ghost in the machine and becomes a machine in the ghost.
Huh.
And that's freaking cool.
That's a really,
right?
I guess they I think in the movie, like Pulse, they kind of play with the technology component of that more. But yeah, I hadn't really, I wish they had gone into some of that a little more in the movies.
I know.
It seems like they, you know what, perhaps they did, because I think in the early 90s, this was actually like a made for TV run.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've, you know, they've been sort of addressing this story for years. And again, we'll talk about The Grudge and how many variations there are of that. But yeah, that's kind of fascinating.
I think it's really cool idea.
The ghost and the machine.
And the machine and the ghost. What? Crazy, right? The way that the victims are all portrayed in this film, in not so much in the American version, but in this particular version where it cuts instantly to either photocopy or newsfeed, then the victims become this copyable thing, because once it's a photo, you can copy it, and then it takes it away from the actual reality of the situation.
Oh.
So then they kind of become closer to Sadako in that they are now copied over and over again.
Right, right. And yeah, while it doesn't always have to be a physical representation, I mean, that's how urban myth works. It's the passing of a story, and now it's an oral tradition.
Right.
Wow. That is pretty cool. Do you want to? I was thinking, let's start talking about the movie itself.
Yes, so much to talk about here.
Early on in the story, Reiko Asakawa is played by Nanako Matsushima. She's the mom protagonist. She shows her son a photograph, and the little kid literally massages his third eye.
Uh-huh.
Did you notice that? I love that moment. It's very subtle, and like little kids are finicky. You don't give it a second thought. But there was a point where I was like, he's warming up his third eye.
Yeah.
Like he's looking into this, or like squeeging off the third eye. I really dug that as a little
squeeging
nod.
Up.
I loved the difference between the tapes themselves this time around, or rather the content on the tapes. In this original, you get actual VHS camera footage composited,
mm-hmm.
and it makes entirely more sense in terms of where Sadako and the spirits are attaching themselves to a VHS tape.
Right.
It doesn't make a ton of sense. It's like it's purely form over function in the Verbinski version, where like all of a sudden the tape has like 8mm black and white film representing the story. In that case, is it Samara? I don't know.
Yeah, but it kind of makes sense, and I see where he was actually coming from, because think about Houssou, and think about how they introduce flashback in Houssou.
Mm-hmm.
It's done with that grainy texture, and the flashback is shown almost like this old tape.
Right.
And so I think that's kind of what he was going for.
I think, well, in Houssou, that feels like, you know, we sort of generically apply like sepia tone to anything that's meant to look old.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just like a visual reference point. And in their case, it's just like the memory, or not memory, but the story they're accessing. It's in the mm-hmm. past. In this case, like it's meant to be something in the ether that has found a home on VHS tape. And yeah, I wasn't wild about the... Now thinking about the Verbinski version, like I don't know, I still feel like it just kind of randomly has this entirely different aesthetic that doesn't really belong there. Especially that it's ethereal, like it shouldn't really be trapped in a place or time. It just felt like a studio note, like, oh, we're looking for something gritty, like David Lynch's Eraserhead, but also The Changeling. Just let it be weird, flies, horses, just so long as it's obviously gritty film. Just have fun with it. We know a guy who can transfer 8mm film to VHS. It's going to look so retro.
It did, though. Let me tell you, when you saw it the first time, you thought, hey, it's not too shabby.
I wondered what happens if you never pick up the phone after you watch the video and the phone rings.
I wondered this too. And I wondered it also about, but it's actually addressed in like Pulse. It's actually addressed. But
it's addressed later in the series. It was actually a trick question because I have the answer.
No. Because like to me, I'd be like, I'm not answering that.
Yeah. In the analog days, that shit would just ring. And even, I don't know, even today with cell phones, it would ring. You'd see an unknown number.
Yeah.
And it's just like, fuck you, Sadako. You can leave a message like any other message I'm not going to listen to.
Yeah, joke's on you. My mailbox is full.
But yeah, so later in the series, she'll just answer the phone for you. She doesn't give a shit.
Oh, good.
Yeah. It's just, yeah, she's going to get in there either way. Well, actually, I could ask you, was it my imagination or the phone stopped playing into the process later on? Because when it comes down to her husband, who's a familiar face, Ryuji Takayama, he doesn't get a call, does he? Nor does the son, for that matter.
The son doesn't get a call. I know that for a fact.
Yeah, so I don't know. They start, even within the movie, they start sort of adapting, I thought. And later in the series, it just comes down to 2 days.
You know what? This is 95 minutes long, this film, so I think it probably just got lost.
Cut for
also,
time.
Also, little kids in 1998 really didn't have phones.
I thought maybe they're too far away from a landline.
Yeah. Don't get caught up in the details, Darren. That's how you find yourself at the bottom of a well.
As the first, well, the first feature film in this series, I liked how little they revealed at any given time. Mm-hmm. It was a really nice build before we see the entirety of the tape and then the sort of like, you know, like post-credit scene, the like bonus feature where we actually get to see her come out of the,
right.
the well. And so that was a really great reveal. And again, going into like the aesthetics, the really awkward movement that, you know, this sort of stylized choreography mm-hmm. that, as it turns out, was her walking backwards and sort of, you know, sort of spazzing a little
right.
bit. And yeah, I don't know. It's unsettling to look at.
You know, I first saw it and I think the English one, I think, is what I saw first of this one. And I had never seen anything quite like it at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it was so creepy. And then, like I said earlier, it influences so many things beyond this film.
Yeah.
But at that time, you had never seen anything like that, especially in America. I understand, like, you know, this is a kabuki, like, traditional look. But for me, I was scared shitless of this. Right?
Yeah, I'm thinking of the like, performers in Silent Hill
mm-hmm.
and how it is this otherworldly, you know, this affected like range of motion
mm-hmm.
and yeah, I mean they do kind of come off as like trapped in these bodies.
Yeah.
The effect of Sadako coming out of the well was accomplished with apparently one special effect, and otherwise it was in the performance. Rai Inuo is a student of kabuki, which plays mm-hmm. a huge part in the aesthetics and the physical movements in this, using an exaggerated motion and jerking movements to emphasize emotion. She was very heavily involved in the sort of character design of Sadako. I wanted to give some credit to Rai Inuo. As to the like bonus feature that isn't in the previous viewings of the Ring tape, it did call to attention that there is a really peculiar sound effect applied to her on-screen death in this, like, you know, sort of looking through time moment where her father gives her a whack.
Yeah.
And she goes down into the well. It is so fucking cartoony. It really took me out. And I had
it's
to rewind
like
it.
It's the Wilhelm kind of ideal of like, you
right?
know?
But it feels like the Wilhelm is occasionally, it's more often than not, like, used organically in a scene.
I never think it is.
No?
It always sounds so silly, like someone was like, whoa.
it's a high pitch. It's more like a wound rather than a fall. Which
yeah.
This was the original. But in this case, it's just, I'm going to play the clip here. And it's like a pull from Mike Tyson's Punch Out. Like, it is such a wacky thwack sound that it kind of took me out. I thought, like, you could have any other sound, or not even. It's on a VHS type that otherwise has no other audio except for that hit. You could have just skipped it.
Right.
Oh, God.
Just turn it down. So the well plays this huge, huge part in the story. This well also plays a part in the Akiku story in the Nine Plates. That's where she gets thrown into that well. There's actually a worm that lives in wells in Japan, and they actually All call right. it the Okiku bug. But it's a worm.
It's a real thing. It's not part of lore.
No, it's a real
okay.
Creature that lives in wells, and they call it that because of that
legend.
Akiku story. Yeah.
Wow.
And that's kind of cool, right? And
yeah.
it's like it's
we don't
got
wanna meet one.
Kind of what looks like strings all over it. And so it's like it's bound, like she in some
her,
of the stories.
Her hair is forever.
Right.
Making an
and
appearance.
So it has like little strings all over it.
Yeah. Wow.
I thought that was kind of cool. Like, it's a great way of like We have nothing cool like that in America, like horror story, horror things that we call life things.
I think every once in a while, at this point, the discoveries are like deep, deep, deep near the ocean floor kind of things. But every once in a while, one of those things gets like a pretty good name, or like, you know, the scientist winds up being a Harry Potter fan, and so they adapt a name from that. But yeah, it happens.
I feel like we're missing out like a lot.
I do miss, and I will say, one of the elements that I did like in the Gore Verbinski remake is the idea that Sadako is always wet.
Mm-hmm.
That lends so much more of an uncomfortable, skin-crawly like feel and also aesthetic, and I kind of miss that here. I felt like a lot of time her hair appears, it's just kind of like, you know, without moisturizer. It's just, just dry
just
hair.
Stringy and nasty.
Oh, and apparently the eye reveal wasn't the actress's eye. It was someone else on set. I don't remember if it was a stuntman or someone. Yeah, but it's a dude.
Yeah, that's kind of cool, though. Like, just change it up. Why not? Bam.
Yeah. I mean, it's one more level of what the hell's going on.
Transitioning now to 2002's Ju-on: The Grudge. Here's the IMDb synopsis. It's a good one. A mysterious and vengeful spirit marks and pursues anybody who dares enter the house in which it resides. The end.
Doesn't sound very scary.
No.
Well, there's not enough words to be scary, but yeah.
It's like one sentence. There you go.
Directed by Takashi Shimizu. Incidentally, he directed Ju-on: The Curse on video originally, and then Ju-on: The Curse 2. Both those were in 2000. And then in 2002, a studio-backed version was called Ju-on: The Grudge. That's this one we're going to talk about. That was the third installment. So the sequel to that one was called The Grudge 2, was actually Grudge 4. Then after that, in 2004, they made The American Grudge with Sarah Michelle Gellar and Grace Zabriskie and Bill Pullman, which Takashi Shimizu also made, followed by the American sequel, Grudge 2, from 2006, still directed by Shimizu, this time starring Amber Tamblyn, followed by the American Grudge 3, starring Shawnee Smith, which takes place in Chicago, Bulgaria. Now, also in 2009, but in Japan, there were two more installments of the Ju-on franchise, Ju-on White Ghost and Ju-on Black Ghost. Mm-hmm. However, continuing in Japan in 2014, they've released Ju-on The Beginning of the End. We're starting to wind down here. Only to be followed by 2015's Ju-on The Final Curse. I don't know if you realize, but we're in a Ju-on movie right now.
This is Ju-on for real this time.
Fun fact, if you took the film reels of all the Ju-on movies and laid them out end to end, you could reach the sun.
Really?
No.
I got really excited by that because I really thought maybe it would go around the earth, but then I was like, what? We could probably reach the moon.
So all the movies start out with the same definition of Ju-on, the idea of this deadly haunting based on the sort of spiritual remains of a terrible, violent act.
Mm-hmm. One thing worth pointing out, Takashi Shimizu did this movie called Marubito.
Okay.
And it's about these underground monster people, which like I kind of got into. I went through this like well of like subway people, mole people kind of thing, and this movie came up like, you might like this. And it's a bizarre, weird underground monster people, and it's also this like it's actually very representative and everything like that, but it's a pretty fun movie and it's worth checking out. It's really weird.
Where does that fall in all his Grudge movies?
Marubito comes in 2004.
Okay, so that's
so it's still pretty
around the American. Yeah, this guy keeps busy.
Yeah,
wow,
busy guy.
Really, really active.
But it's a bizarre film. Stories. Worth checking out.
Shimizu stated in an interview that the inspiration for Ju-on came from his own personal fears as a child, from a Japanese dance group that would paint their nude bodies white and perform. Shimizu found the performances frightening and decided to paint his ghost white. But we've already talked about whether it's like white clothing, that of funeral garb, or in this case, white is just kind of, you know, that ethereal separation.
Right. And this also reminded me, the way that everything was painted with the white and the eyeliner and everything like that, it really, to me, struck me going back to the first J horror episode when we talked about the differences between maximalism and minimalism.
Yeah, well, even that idea that like the Western culture is aiming for realism, right, while Eastern,
and this to me, like, clearly this kid's wearing eyeliner, but it gives you this totally different experience.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you understand that it's not going for realism, I think it's that much more effective.
Yeah, I didn't even think about the eyeliner makeup, but now that I think about it, it's pretty obviously there.
Yeah.
I felt while this is a much rougher film, it still has some pretty great scares. I think I would give the upper hand to the American version of this, but again, it's just this guy's been telling these stories so long that, like, I think the American version is the culmination of, like, everything he had learned from all the versions before that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there were. I love a security camera ghost.
Oh. I love a security camera ghost. My most favorite scene in this whole movie is when she's in the elevator.
Oh, yeah.
The sister. And every floor, Toshio's there.
Yeah.
And it's just one of the best things that I've ever seen.
I like that one a lot, yeah.
You know, it's so creepy. I also love when one of the characters, because there's a lot of characters. There's a lot of people and a lot of names that gets a little confusing, honestly.
And the movie's cut up into six segments, and it's like Clerks except with character headings. And so each chapter follows a different character. I didn't feel like that really added anything useful. I appreciate that, like, it's a difference in your approach to this narrative.
Yeah.
But I didn't think it really helped or hurt. If it was a little distracting.
I kind of liked it because I liked the order that it was presented to me in as well, because it does come full circle back around. Yeah. And then it shows the spread of the grudge and the way that it kind of takes over. There's a scene where the social worker is at lunch and a cat runs across her feet. And then there's like Toshio under the table. God, there's some really great scary scenes. I think Ringu's great. And Ju-on's great, right? But there's some really scary stuff in this. And when you go back and finally watch it after all these years, it's worth the rewatch.
Yeah, yeah. I thought Toshio, it's interesting that he is not a particularly malicious spirit. He's just kind of, you know, trapped in the same circumstances. But he is used to great effect.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, like, as the, you know, he is a ghost, but him as the ghost helper lends to, you know, dynamics that we don't often get in ghost stories, because they are these sort of singular things. You've got a singular haunting, but in this case, like, this is a family slaughter tragedy. So
yeah,
there are those figures all involved. I thought I did like the aesthetic that comes with Toshio haunting this house, and how there's just like garbage everywhere. How, you know, and it's all seemingly like snack food wrappers,
right,
and things of that sort.
It's like kid stuff.
Right, right.
And that's the old woman.
Feral
like
kid
that
stuff. Oh, I kind of thought it was Toshio. I thought, like, she is like, she's immobilized for the majority
of
the movie.
I think she's kind of being like, well, you see all the wrappers around her. So I kind of assumed like Toshio was kind of like being kind of one with her.
Yeah, but we also know Toshio likes to like hang over people. So like,
yeah, he's a creep.
In the later scenes, we see him just straight up leaning over over people. But I'm picturing him just like
eating candy and looking in your face while you sleep,
having a Twinkie and still staring at you in between bites.
Could you imagine? You're an old lady that can't. She's pretty much
she's comatose. Yeah,
yeah,
she's a vegetable.
And so it's like, oh, P.S. this ghost comes and looks over my face and eats snack food like all night long.
Of course I'm terrified. Yeah, no, that actress, there, wow, the level of like host without a spirit that was present in that woman was so fucking eerie that like
that's
she really
she gets
was a
to live
shell.
That's why she gets to live and no one else does, because she's not there.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, back to Toshio. I don't mind the idea of being like a snack ghost. I'll eat junk food for the rest of eternity. Why, that actually sounds pretty okay.
I'm also, because I'm never going to gain any weight or get diabetes or anything.
Yeah,
you know,
totally. You're just going to maintain your very pale, gaunt figure forever.
That's how I look already. That's how I look right now. Done. The sound effects in Ju-on are so good. To be a Foley artist for this film had to have been so inventive. There's so many squitches and squelches. And then the thing that everyone associates with this movie, the vocal fry. And in my studio...
I haven't thought of it as vocal fry,
studio at NYU, my students, we do vocal fry because it's a great way to calm down the singing mechanism.
Okay.
And so we do a controlled kind of vocal fry. And when I try and explain that to some of my students, like, oh, try this vocal fry, and then I give an example of it, they're like, oh, like The Grudge. Every single one tells me, oh, like The Grudge.
That's awesome.
Yeah, just like The Grudge. Just make The Grudge sound.
Now, after you saw, I'm assuming you saw the American remake in the theater?
Yes.
Did it follow like a 2-week period where you and your friends are calling each other and making that fucking noise on the phone? Because I got those calls.
No, we never did that.
No, it's a great setup.
Moshimashi, onii-chan? Sakki iie no hou ni denwa shita ndakedo. Moshimashi, onii-chan? Chotto, henna joudan yamete yo.
You know, certain movies, like, we did that with, and some we didn't. You know, that stupid movie, The Happening, still occasionally Jax and I will be walking down the street, and suddenly he'll start walking backwards and think he's really fucking funny. And you're like, this is not even a good movie. But no, we never called each other and was like, you know?
Missed opportunity.
Damn, I could have been doing vocal fry all this time.
So yeah, as far as curses go, this one sucks for everybody because you're initiated before you even know your options. You could have been delivering a pizza to that fucking house and like, if I had not come inside to let the person get cash, I might have walked away with my life. But no, presto changeo, I'm cursed.
Yeah, it doesn't matter who you are or what you are, cat too, you're getting involved. Nope. Unless you're like an empty shell of a person, for the most part, you get to hang out.
So as we're winding down, these two figures, these two spirits in particular, up to this point in the film series, are just kind of forces of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's not, and we talked about how even in the ghost realm, the idea that these figures are stripped down to one singular purpose.
Right.
And in this case, it's revenge. It's, you know, just sort of sadistic
murder.
Death. And so in that way, like they become... Yeah, like we talked about before, like these autonomous like software programs, they're mm-hmm. like spiritual malware that removed from any purpose. And that it's kind of a new turn, especially as they enter the American markets in terms of like there's no morality tales here.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing anyone ever did wrong was watch a video or walk into the wrong house. And it just comes down to, like, wrong place, wrong time.
Right.
And so in that way, like, there's something, I don't know, I feel differently about these. Maybe that's why I can't rally behind these characters. You know, there's something appealing to a Freddy. They've, you know,
sure.
There's an inherent, you know, like, you're rooting for the bad boy, ultimately. And, but these two figures... I don't want them to win. Like
I don't care about the people that much either.
I only feel bad for everybody involved.
I like to see the situation and the big overview of it, but I don't really care what happens to any of the people.
Yeah, in a way, these are almost like natural disaster movies in terms
kind of
like not really having a villain.
Because there's nothing you can do. And,
right.
And to me, I love movies always where I can imagine myself in the situation and say, oh, I would have done this or I would have whatever. But this, you're just like, fucked. It's kind of like in that way, it's like The Stand and Captain Trips. Like you're going to get it or you're not.
Yeah.
There's no way around it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So in the very Japanese tradition, and I'm speaking specifically of like kaiju movies and making their monsters battle, they did eventually arrive at last year's Sadako versus Kayako, or The Ring versus The Grudge.
Right.
And yeah, I don't know. It's like twins fighting. It's not really a visual spectacle.
The Grudge would totally win.
Yeah. Well, okay. So it's on Shudder.
Okay.
And I watched it this morning. And so I don't have a full review, but I do have a couple bullet points. Ultimately, I liked it. Like, I was entertained. I dug it enough. I think if one is like a really big fan of these movies, then absolutely you should watch it. There's some pretty clever stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a lot of silly stuff.
Oh, is it funny? It's a funny movie?
No.
Oh, it's just silly.
It's got a professor character that's pretty pathetic.
I see.
And yeah, so I don't know. Again, like the sensibilities are a little different, so I don't know if he's goofy for comedic effect.
Or if
he's just goofy because the story is a little weird. Early in the movie, they address both legends in like a modern folklore and urban myth college class to start off. And that's the professor who's obsessed with the idea of a tape that is out there. And you watch it. And then for some reason, over time, it's become 2 days. It's no longer 7. It's not a week.
It's just faster.
Yeah.
Well, you know, time speeds up.
Right.
You know,
for editing's sake, let's narrow this this period of time.
As it's evolved over time.
Yeah. And the tape, what's on the tape itself has also changed pretty dramatically. I'm not going to spoil what that is. But so lucky for him, two girls in his class discover a tape in an old VHS deck in like a secondhand store.
Sounds like VHS.
Yeah, and they take it home, and I will say this is the first life the texting has ever saved, because one of the girls isn't watching it while the other
she's
one...
She's texting?
Because she's texting.
Oh, I hate texting in movies. So, like, the person who actually deserved to die didn't.
Yeah, there's some irony to that, yeah. We just talked about, like, culpability, and up to this point, like, every time someone dies at the hand of a Kayako or... You know, the spirit really should say, it's not you, it's me.
Right.
Yeah, but in this case, so one of the girls is cursed. They get the phone call. They don't answer, and the phone just picks up on its own.
Fair
so
enough.
That answer, that answers that earlier question. When they bring the tape to the dorky professor, he's so excited to modernize it and transfer it from VHS to DVD.
But why does he want to do this?
This movie came out last
year. Is he the
year.
Grudge? Because, like, why would he want to do this?
No. He self-published a book on the Ring tape. So he's kind of an expert. He's seemingly spending college money.
So then he knows it's going to kill people. And then he makes the copy.
He wants to know it for himself, like, firsthand. I think he's become so obsessed with the idea that he... Yeah, he wants to know for himself. At least that's the speculation.
All right, fair enough.
But yeah, I was just kind of stuck on he's changing it from VHS to DVD, and he's very excited about that. Like, that's not...
Yeah, put that shit on iTunes.
Yeah. What? Okay, so one character actually does become, like, broken by the whole curse and loads it up online.
Okay.
And she has this, like, creepy sort of falling apart monologue about how, yeah, everyone will see it and everyone will die. It was pretty fucked up. It was fun. That's weird. That's what I just said was weird. The haunted house from The Grudge is locked up but still accessible because the local neighborhood kids, like, use it to scare each other.
Oh, okay.
And, like, bully a kid into the house.
So then he's all grudge-worthy.
Yeah, that's a great... I don't want to spoil anything about that,
okay.
But I will say, like, large rocks were involved, and it's darkly comedic.
Really?
Yeah. It plays a bigger part eventually, but yeah, the idea is that this neighborhood, just 5 kids disappear, and they don't know.
Okay, which was happening at the end of the first Grudge,
yeah.
Is like all these disappearing kids.
Yeah. So yeah, there's a lot of fun stuff in there. I thought it's worth a watch. If you like these movies, you know, to even a modest degree, it's worth having a look. That one's up on Shudder. I think it's one of their exclusives for a while.
Okay.
But that'll close us out for this episode. I think this much more fun episode.
Yeah, least, I had much more fun with this one.
The work into it was a lot more fun. The conversation, yeah, I mean, it's how it goes. Like, when the movies are great, we have fun. When the movies are terrible, we have fun sort of making fun.
Right.
But the middle ground stuff, we're kind of like, it's a challenge to make this dynamic. Yeah. But this is great. Excited. Next time you hear us, we're going to be coming back with part 3 of our J-Horror, which J-Horror in the loosest terms.
We really dived right in there.
Yeah, we are not taking any breaks this time around.
Like, hadn't featured an any horror J-horror film before.
And then exclusively for three weeks in a row. Yeah, and I've had it on the mind. Now I've got a list of other movies I've got to see also.
Well, I do learn something every time, every episode, then I learn something more to look for. So.
Yeah,
so for next time, we have our guest, Charles from Miskatonic Musings.
Yeah, Charles is going to join us. Over the years, listening to Miskatonic, I did notice that he has sometimes a profoundly deep understanding and knowledge of kaiju movies and men in big rubber suits fighting. Yes. And so I thought, while we're in the, geographical hemisphere of Japan, why don't we close this out with something really fun? And so I went back and forth with Charles, and we got a recommended list of things to mm-hmm. check out, and we had to narrow it down to three. So it's going to be two Godzilla movies and X from Outer Space.
I'm so excited about X from Outer Space.
How do they describe the X, the monster?
They describe it as a giant chicken lizard alien monster. And I was down for that. Because you gave me a couple options, and I read this description. I was like, yes, chicken lizard alien monster.
That's awesome. It's going to be, it's going to be like watching the National Enquirer cover front page fight it out with Godzilla. Well, I guess not Godzilla in this particular
movie. And how, scary is a chicken going to be?
I'm trying to remember if I recognize that guy from the other movies. I don't think I did. So, I don't know. Some of the monsters are kind of cute. They kind of a throwback to the, Japanese spirits that are more, woodland nymph type weird creatures.
Well, I'm excited.
So that'll be next week, part three of our J-Horror. Joining us will be Charles from Miskatonic Musings. And so that'll do it for this. We're on all the typical social media places. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Rants Macabre. And our website is therantsmacabre.com. And you can email us at therantsmacabre@gmail.com. We're on Patreon too, where we are finishing up an episode on Telephone Terror, where we talk about a couple classics and a couple, ones that deserve to be classic.
Yeah, fair statement.
That's on patreon.com/rantsmacabre. For $1 a month, you can get access to our exclusive library of stuff that you haven't heard here on this podcast stream. That's everything, right?
That's all the things.
Also really useful when you're online next, if you could swing by iTunes and drop us a review. It goes a long way in helping us spread the podcast and raises up in the rankings. So, drop us a line.
Give us one some way stars. Or another.
Give us some stars. That's it for me. This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.